We've been listening to coverage on the air of George Floyd's funeral from Houston Public Media from KUHF-FM in Houston, Texas. Now at Central Time, I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll leave Earth for a short while to catch up on the latest discoveries in our galaxy. First, the coronavirus outbreak may have slipped a bit from the headlines, but public health experts say it's still around and spreading across the U.S. We're going to take a closer look now at how virus hotspots have been shifting in recent weeks and some ways that we can assess our risk when it comes to things like eating at restaurants or summer travel. Dr. Jonathan Temte is with us. He's Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Temte, welcome back to the show.
Well, greetings and good afternoon to you, Rob. And all I can say is we're living in monumental times.
There's a lot going on to keep track of. Well, I want to start here in Wisconsin. Some new numbers came out, the daily numbers from the state. It looks like that key indicator a lot of people are watching for, the percentage of positive tests, continues to go down in Wisconsin. So at least at some level, some good news there here in the state.
Yeah, that's good news for two things. One, it implies that we are ramping up the amount of testing we're doing, which is really necessary to have a good sense for how much of this virus is out there.
And then some news that was out there that I think has a lot of people confused right now, a statement in a press conference from a World Health Organization, one of their experts there saying this case of this idea of asymptomatic transmission, somebody who gets the virus, never shows symptoms. They say transmission of the disease in that case, rare. They've walked that back a little bit. Can you sort that out for us?
It is very confusing. But keep in mind that if we look at anybody out there, two-thirds of us over the course of a month will have some symptom of something. We all have, from time to time, runny noses, a sore throat, a headache, fatigue, and so on. And all these symptoms are part of possible coronavirus infection. And so there really isn't anything that we can totally hang our hat on and say, aha, we have the symptom complex that means they have this. What gets confusing is we know that individuals, when they are infected with SARS-CoV-2, will start shedding the virus before they get symptoms. They can then have symptoms, and the symptoms can go from very minimal symptoms, such as a runny nose or sore throat, all the way up to needing to be in the intensive care unit and worse. And so it's really, really hard to sort all of this out. Suffice to say that almost everybody who comes down with this for a period of time before they have symptoms can spread. And so it really depends on what definition we're using. But the bottom line is, to be safe, we have to maintain the distancing. We have to be vigilant about using the face masks while in public until we have a better control of this virus.
We've seen new hotspots apparently emerging. You know, good news like Wisconsin, I mentioned that percentage going down. I think we had a day with no deaths attributed to coronavirus recently. New York City, numbers going way down. But then we're seeing record numbers of hospitalizations in places like Texas. So what do you make of the shift in focus for where the disease seems to be on the rise versus where it's falling?
Well, if you take a look across the country, and I looked at the patterns for each state a little bit earlier this afternoon, and you can kind of divide it into three groups. One that had a really big peak early on and dropped off, and these are primarily in the northwest or northeast part, kind of the New York, New Jersey avenue. You have states like Wisconsin that had a steady increase. We kind of peaked out. We came back on down. And unfortunately, we have somewhere around 20, 22 states that look like they are accelerating up right now. But with any virus, these get spread differently. They end up in different locations at different times. There are different behaviors, different interactions, and so on. And at the end of the day, you end up with a patchwork of different epidemics and different epidemic curves. Suffice to say that across the entire United States, we saw a big wave come up, drop down, and unfortunately, we're starting to rise again a little bit.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Temte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on COVID-19 and how we can stay safe. If you have a question, call in quick at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about what we know at this point about the virus and what we can do to stay safe. You mentioned the masks, Dr. Temte. When do we want to have that mask on in general?
Well, I think we want to have that mask on any time that we can't maintain a distance from other people of basically about 6 feet. I'm just recently looked at a new, very well done study published in The Lancet that talks about all the different things that we do. And they're able to show that the physical distancing really does make a huge difference. They're able to show that the use of face masks independently of the distancing makes a difference. And in particular, that face mask is very important when you're in closer contact. Finally, they looked at eye protection, and in fact, that was beneficial as well. So the long and short of it is, if you can maintain that distance from other people, do so. If you can't, you know, for short periods of time, make sure you have a face covering of some sort. It can be a surgical mask. It can be a cloth face covering. But those are shown to be effective in prevention of transmission.
How do we measure how big an impact doing things like reopening stores or reopening restaurants will have, or as we've seen over the last week, large-scale protests with people mostly outside but in close proximity? How do we measure whether events like those change the curve, add more cases?
It gets really complicated because we have so many different things going at the same time. So, for example, we are now entering into warmer and more humid days. I'm sitting in my office with the air conditioner off, and I'm feeling the heat build on up here. But between that and the relaxation of all sorts of things at the same time, so the stay-at-home orders, the opening of business, we have a lot going on at the same time. Typically, what we do is look over the period of 7 to 14 days after a large event and look for, is there a change in the curve? Unfortunately, what we have in a population is a lot of mixing going on. And the more we mix, the more it kind of blurs and blunts that effect. But so, for example, right now, with the amount of close contact with protests going on, one would be looking in the next week to 2 weeks to look for any change in that curve shape.
There's been some reporting that some recent surges have been in rural areas, in particular around the country. Why might that be?
Well, again, people are mobile, and the viruses that you have keep with you for basically somewhere around 3 weeks that you're possible or possibly infecting another person. So as we relax more, we travel more, we put on more miles on the car, get out to the rural areas, to parks and so on, the potential that we encounter people that we don't live close by to increases quite dramatically. And it just takes one infected person coming into a new community to trigger off another round of infection. And so it really gets down to the amount of social mixing we have.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Julie is with us in Oshkosh. Julie, hi.
Hi. So my question has to do with ventilation systems, because I teach at a university, and as we're considering going back to face-to-face interactions with our students, which would be really good in a lot of ways, even if most of us are wearing masks, can the virus be spread through the ventilation systems? You know, so even if I'm distant from my students.
Julie, thanks for the call. And a lot of office workers and others wondering that same question, Dr. Temte.
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, what we know is that good ventilation, and particularly with air movement that will carry things away from people, is a good thing. We also know that the risk of infection indoors might be as high as 18 or 19 times more than outdoors. So, and if you think when you're out in the open, you're subjected to the breeze moving air along, and that really can help reduce the risk of becoming infected. We also know from old studies, one of my favorite of a airliner parked up on the runway in Alaska for 3 hours. There was one person on that plane with influenza, and within 3 days, 72% of the passengers had influenza. Following cases like that, the airline industry totally changed the ventilation system in planes. And so moving from a closed space to an open space, so that ventilation system really has to move air through and not air around.
Thanks a lot for that call, Julie. Appreciate it. What kind of activities, Dr. Tempty, do you think people might want to avoid, or events or whatever, at least over the next couple of few months?
Well, I think first and foremost, the big no is large crowds inside a building where you're closely packed in a shared airspace. Being outdoors is probably the best thing, and fortunately, we're in that nice 3 to 4 month segment during our Wisconsin year, where being outdoors is much more enjoyable.
Time for one more quick caller. Melanie is with us in La Crosse. Melanie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Tempty, this is my question. I am a concerned grandmother. And so this is in regards to, I've had to say, ask my daughter to not have my grandson, whom I cherish greatly, not to be coming over to my home. I mean, how do you have this conversation? The reason why is that there is a change in his Monday through Thursday childcare, and he is now going to a large type of gathering.
In... Gotcha, Melody. We just have a minute left, Dr. Tempty. Do you want to tackle it? Kid goes to a childcare setting, a larger group. Should they go visit grandma?
Yeah, well, we know that from daycare in general, that respiratory viruses such as the SARS virus can spread child to child. And so you're always at risk not only to your grandchild, but to the sphere of other children that child's around. So I think just expressing gently to your daughter about your concern about what happens if you become ill and your desire to have many years ahead to cherish with your grandson is probably the most important message.
Thanks for that call. And Dr. Tempty, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you, Rob. Always a pleasure. Take care now.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us today to talk about where we're at in the coronavirus outbreak and how we can assess our own risks. Coming up after the news, there's a black hole that's a lot closer to Earth than we previously thought. Still a long way away, though. We'll learn more about that story and other big news from space. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Calls to cut funding for police departments and in some cases abolish them have risen in recent days after the death of George Floyd. Coming up, we'll look at what both options could involve and what they would mean for the communities police serve. First, for many people, black holes can feel abstract and so far away they might as well be science fiction. But a recent discovery shows that black holes are a lot closer to Earth than previously known. Our next guest joins us to talk about that story and other big news from space. David Eicher is editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine. It's based in Waukesha. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with this black hole, David. Now, I say it's closer than we thought. It's still not exactly in our backyard, right?
That's right. It's about 1,100 light years away. A light year is the distance that light travels in a year. It's about 6 trillion miles. So that is a long hike. And by comparison, the closest star system to us is 4 light years away.
So by that standard, a long way away, by the standards of galaxies and universes, pretty close. This is significantly closer than any previously discovered black hole. Do I have that right?
That's right. It's the closest known black hole to us in the galaxy. And there's a little bit of a paradox here, because we know that massive stars that are several times the mass of the sun ultimately form black holes when they die. There ought to be millions of black holes in our Milky Way galaxy, and we know of about 24. The problem is that they're very hard to detect, and they have to be interacting with another object that lets us detect that they're there. That's exactly what has happened with this system that, as you say, is now the record holder for being the closest black hole to us.
Yeah, talk about how we researchers discovered this particular black hole. What signs were out there for us?
This is a black hole that's a collapsed star that's about four times the mass of our sun. And when it exhausts its fuel, it can go super dense and become this object that not even light can escape from. It's only detectable to us because, and only recently through research short time ago, because it's in a triple star system. And so we can see the effects that the black hole, that one of the two stars that's still, if you will, in its normal life is orbiting this black hole, and we can see the effects gravitationally of that, of the black hole and what it does to this star.
Sounds like hypothetically there could be a whole mess of black holes out there that we would have no way of seeing because they're not near enough something big enough to interact with, so we can't detect them.
That's absolutely right. And we know that massive stars, ultimately, many of them become black holes. There are many millions, countless tens of millions of massives, hundreds of millions in our galaxy alone. So we know that there are many, many black holes out there that we don't know of. And there could be black holes that are much lighter in their mass than a massive star. These so-called micro black holes as well could be relatively close to us, and we wouldn't have any way of knowing it. Until they got so close, they would be a big problem.
Now, what do black holes tell us about this universe we live in?
They tell us a lot of things, and one of the main things is that they tell us that Albert Einstein was right, that his relativistic view of physics in the universe and how space-time behaves, that it's curved and that that relativity holds depending on where the observer is and what the observer is experiencing, is true. They also tell us that that's the most massive and most extreme state of matter ends up in a black hole here, there, and everywhere in the universe. They tell us the universe is extremely large because there are many, many of them, and they're a long way away, even the closest ones, we think. And they tell us that maybe, just maybe, you could go close to a black hole, and you could possibly even go into what's called a supermassive black hole and maybe get to another place and time in the universe, although that's hypothetical.
And it sounds uncomfortable.
Well, the problem is with a stellar black hole, you fall into it and it would actually, the forces would pull you into a string of spaghetti, a human being who would be about 10 kilometers long. So that it kind of doesn't matter where you come out. If that happens to you, it kind of ruins your whole week.
Talking to David Eicher, editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, looking at some of the latest stories in space news. Now, here's one. Astronomers have been observing radio bursts from deep space, and I'd like to imagine it's some sort of intergalactic call-in talk show. It's not that, though. They're these fast radio bursts, they're called. What are they?
They're very mysterious, and this is really on the cutting edge. We're in a golden age of astronomical discovery. There's more research going on now than there ever has been before. We know the answers to a lot of important questions that people have been wondering about for eons. This is one that we don't know the answer to, though. Fast radio bursts are extremely energetic, very distant bursts of fairly low energy radiation in the radio part of the spectrum. And it's not known what they are, but not only have they been observed for about a little more than a decade now, but we now know that there are a couple of them that repeat. They're not just sort of a one-off event, but they have some period to them. And this is really confusing astronomers how that could be. Could they be very, very dense spinning neutron stars that are made of just neutrons that, again, are sort of a dead star remnant that are very, very dense, that have very strong magnetic fields? Could they be mergers of some kind of super dense objects that are somehow spinning? Could they be supermassive black holes? Could they be something else that we don't know about at all? And this period, the fact that we're hearing, if you will, in radio, some of them with a regular period, this one that was discovered relatively recently, has a 157-day period, and it's about 3 billion light years away. That's a long way away in the universe. That means that maybe something is spinning and it shows itself to us every 157 days, that part that's spitting out this energy toward us.
Wow. Well, I want to take our last couple minutes to come a little closer to home, to Jupiter. NASA's Juno spacecraft has been orbiting Jupiter now for about 4 years. Can you talk about the kind of undertaking it was, first of all, to get this Juno probe to Jupiter?
Big deal, and it followed an earlier mission that was a little more extravagant called Galileo. But Juno has been looking sort of at the origin and the evolution, sort of the physical nature of Jupiter for the last several years. It's, of course, by far the largest planet, and it's very, very interesting because it's weird. I mean, you could put, you know, a 318 Earths would make up one Jupiter mass, and it's 88,000 miles across. It's huge. You could fit 1,300 Earths within it. And it really, there are lots of discoveries, but some of the strangest, because it's in a sort of a polar orbit that's going way out, then coming very close to Jupiter, this spacecraft Juno, and it showed us that there are these groups of cyclones near Jupiter's poles, these huge cyclonic storms that we don't quite understand yet. It also shows that the clouds of Jupiter, the compounds in clouds like ice and ammonia and hydrogen, of course, and helium, are moving around in very strange ways depending on where you are relative to the equator. It's shown that the planet has a huge kind of amorphous, massive center rather than a compact core, or rather than just gases within it, and an extremely weird and unique magnetic field that's totally different in the north from the south, as if it was just bent and contorted, this sort of magnetic poles of the planet. And nobody knows why that is yet. But what's going on here may tell us also about the early history of Earth when we understand it all.
Yeah, this sounds like one of those cases where each answer generates, what, 5 or 10 more questions.
And that's both the joy and the problem with science, because planetary scientists and cosmologists here on both ends here are not going to run out of things to do anytime soon.
And with Jupiter, did I see this right? You take Jupiter's mass and then you stack up all the other planets in the solar system and there's still more of Jupiter?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's dwarfed, of course, by the sun in size and mass, but it's vastly larger than the aggregate of all the rest of the planets, indeed.
Well, before we wrap up, David, we've hit some exciting news from across the galaxy and here in the solar system. What is an emerging story that you are excited about that you're watching for the next results or analysis or whatever it might be?
Well, I think another thing here is this business about finding some of the missing mass in the universe. And that is, for a long time, mass and energy make up the whole of what we have in the universe. Einstein taught us that. For a long time, we didn't know what the normal matter was exactly made of and why we couldn't find it all. Baryons are what we're made of: planets, stars, galaxies, cats, dogs, trees, humans. And we know that it's only about 5% of the mass and energy in the universe. But we could only find about half that much in the surveying. And recent work is going on with this that has shown that a lot of this mass, a lot of these atoms, are spread out in a sort of a hot plasma between the galaxies. And work is going on that. So again, we're finding out many, many times. Once again, we found out that Albert Einstein is right again.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much.
David Eicher is the editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. He joined us today to catch us up on some of the latest news from space. Coming up, we'll look at calls to defund or abolish police departments and what it could mean for the cities they serve. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to UW-Madison, traffic volume on city highways has been cut by nearly half this spring because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up, we'll look at how stay-at-home orders are affecting short- and long-term transportation plans here in Wisconsin. Now, over the past few days, calls to defund police departments have grown out of the protests against the death of George Floyd. In Madison last night, demonstrators painted defund the police in giant yellow letters on Martin Luther King Boulevard leading up to the Capitol building. In Milwaukee, activists are demanding a 10% cut to the police department budget. And in Minneapolis, where Floyd died while being arrested on Memorial Day, a majority of the city council say they support disbanding the entire department and coming up with a new way to approach public safety. Here's Minneapolis City Council President Lisa Bender at a rally Sunday afternoon.
Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, to end policing as we know it, and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
But Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says he's opposed to abolishing the department. Jacqueline Helfgott is a professor in the Criminal Justice Department and director of the Crime and Justice Research Center at Seattle University. Jacqueline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, people have had a wide range of calls in response to the police departments lately, anything from small reforms to, it sounds like, complete abolition. Let's start at that end. If people are meaning literally to defund the police department, what do you make of those calls?
Well, I think people mean different things when they say defund the police departments. I think we all owe George Floyd's family and every Black American and person of color who has to fear the police an apology and a promise that law enforcement in the United States will never again be the same as it was the day before George Floyd was killed by police. But at this same time, I think a lot of major reforms have been underway in the law enforcement for many years. Police culture is changing, and we need the police. So, you know, we have many reforms underway. We have a movement here in Washington State, the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission. Sue Rahr, the executive director of the Training Commission, who was on Barack Obama's task force on 21st century policing, has been working since 2012 to replace warrior-oriented training with guardian-oriented training in the Basic Law Enforcement Academy in Washington State. Seattle Police Department has been under consent decree since 2012, has made enormous strides in terms of accountability processes, use of force policies, and implementation of crisis intervention training, including having police officers and social workers, mental health professionals go out to see to crisis calls. So a lot of work has been underway for many years. That is directly in line with what many proponents of the defunding the police movement have been arguing for. So a lot of that is already underway. I would, argue that much of what is already being done in policing is directly in line with much of those who are calling for defunding the police. Much of that is already in place. I would also say that we need the police. The police are first responders to a broad range of public safety issues and serious crime. And there's a lot that's broken in all areas of society, in all different institutions in society, and education and health and social services. And a lot, all of that goes to, gets, I don't want to say dumped, but the police end up being first responders to all of that. So crime will not end if we abolish or defund the police. And if we do defund the police, we're going to have a situation where there's going to be delayed response to 911 calls. There'll be fewer police on the streets. And ultimately, it's going to negatively impact marginalized people who, you're going to have neighborhoods where people in wealthier neighborhoods will hire private security, which they're already doing in many neighborhoods. And the poorer neighborhoods will have to fend for themselves even more than they've already had to. And all of that has the potential to increase fear of crime, have an impact on crime victims and communities, especially communities of color, even more so than it's already been the case.
One argument that I've heard that's a little more nuanced and harder to sum up in a slogan is the idea that we are dumping too many things on police departments. And I think I've seen suggestions in Minneapolis. Can we change things so that police mainly are dealing with crime prevention and reaction, and take some of those other things, mental health, homelessness, and try to have our, or their, in that case, emergency response system be something other than police departments. Is that something you've seen tried or experimented with?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, so let me back up and say one of the issues I have with the defunding the police argument is that it's compartmentalizing these different agencies. What I have seen here in Seattle is police, public safety, medical services, social workers, mental health, you know, working together to holistically address problems in the community. And that's the part of policing that I feel like a lot of people, when they hear the word police, they think of, and of course the images we see, these militaristic images, that's what many people think of when they think of the police. But if you really work with the police, I've worked, you know, in with police agencies in, you know, many different capacities, doing research, serving on committees. If you really see what's being done in many communities, it's not all about militaristic fronting and policing. And there's many within police agencies who are trying to change that. So to answer your question, you know, I think we're in a place where we can build on existing reforms and build police agencies in ways that are restorative and holistic and community driven and that have accountability processes in place, which is what the defunding police proponents are asking for. You know, my take on it would be, no, let's not defund the police. Let's build on the reforms that many have been working very hard on in many communities and many police agencies. Let's build on that. Let's change the way policing is done so policing is never the same as it was the day before George Floyd was killed by police. But let's build on the reforms that we already have in place, many of which were outlined in Obama's task force on 21st century policing. You know, much of that is being done in different agencies around the country. Is it being done in every agency in the country? Does it need to be done in a way that we make sure that all police agencies are doing these things? Yes, we're nowhere near where we need to be, but let's build on reforms that we already have in place.
Talking to Jacqueline Helfgott, professor of criminal justice at Seattle University, looking at calls for changes in American policing. One of our producers, Rachel Vasquez, reported on demonstrators in Madison last night. She talked with a woman named Sakara Wages. She says she supports defunding the police, but shifting those resources to other places. Here's a listen.
Housing is a major issue here. Like, it is so expensive to live in Madison. So I'd like to see some sort of subsidies there. I'd like to see investments in mental health, decolonize mental health. I'd like to see just community services in general, because the police have become social workers with guns, right? So why not invest into the community and answer some of the needs that need to be met?
So the idea, investing in other things that, in theory, would hopefully prevent crime in the first place. What do you make of that call, Jacqueline?
Well, I think that's, you know, we do need more resources going into mental health and social services and housing. Most definitely we need that. The only thing I would not agree with is that we need to take money away from the police to put into those other components of the system. I think we need the police as public safety partners with all of these different institutions and elements of society and communities. And yes, we need more money for housing and education, and we need to reduce disparities in all of those different areas. So yes, let's re-envision the way policing is done, but police are going to be the first responders. And they're going to be still dealing with those issues, but let's do it in a way that includes them, doesn't take away their resources to put into these other places, but let's figure out a way that everyone can come to the table to address these injustices and disparities and change the way justice is done more holistically.
Jacqueline, I'm going to wrap up giving you just 30 seconds for a big question. You mentioned consent decrees. The Trump administration publicly pulled back from a lot of those with the departments around the country. Do you think those were or should be a bigger tool in our toolkit?
I think they are a tool. I mean, they have helped create major reforms in police agencies. And, you know, we need some kind of oversight to help make those changes in different police agencies across the country. You know, there's a lot that still needs to be done. Not all agencies have made the reforms that those agencies that have been under consent decrees have made. So we need some mechanism in order to make sure policing changes everywhere in every jurisdiction across the country.
Jacqueline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jacqueline Helfgott, professor in the Criminal Justice Department and director of the Crime and Justice Research Center at Seattle University. We talked with her about the push to defund and in some cases abolish police departments, a wide variety of messages coming from protesters and politicians when it comes to reforming police departments. You can share your thoughts with us on those issues. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you remember what you had for dinner a week ago today? How about a month ago today? Well, maybe not unless you keep a food diary. How about 110 million years ago? Okay, trick question. We weren't humans back then. But dinosaur researchers in Canada can tell us what a particular dinosaur ate 110 million years ago, you know, give or take. As reported in Popular Science, the remains of an ankylosaur found in a mine in Alberta were so well-preserved that even its last meal came through intact in fossil form. The meal? Ferns, with a side of charcoal. Researchers think the 1.5-ton herbivore had been grazing on new ferns that had grown up on the site of a forest fire. That's where the charcoal comes from. This particular dinosaur was part of a big group called ankylosaurs, which I just learned today includes a whole bunch of different families of dinosaurs. It would have been covered in bony plates and had a spiny spike sticking out from each shoulder. Researchers say the discovery could give us some insight into the ecology of herbivore dinosaurs, though they point out that one meal in one dinosaur doesn't answer all their questions. If you at home are thinking about recreating the ankylosaur's last meal, don't. Charcoal, not very tasty, and according to some quick internet research, most ferns you're going to find out there, not edible for humans. Dinosaur news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.